Let us begin with prayer. Most gracious and loving God, you who created families to provide for our nurture and development, and who brought us into your large family, the church, remind us of our foibles and fallibility. Enable us to strip away our illusions and idealizations of who we are. Help us to face up to ourselves and to each other. And through it all, keep us ever aware of your love and care, in order that we might be the expressive presence of your grace to other members of your human family, through the power of him who is our older brother, even Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen. We come this morning to the last of the three Adams lectures on the family delivered by Dr. Richard L. Hester. But first, I wish to express our appreciation to those who have visited with us this week, especially those who participated in the minister's conference. Many of us have had the privilege of talking with many of you during the week, and it's always good to have alumni and friends on campus, especially to have you during this week of fellowship and growing together. In introducing Professor Hester, like the two presiders before me, I will take a more personal approach. Almost 30 years ago, I did what you have done. I went to seminary. And like many of you, I went to orientation and to the picnic welcoming new students. But there was a difference. For entertainment, they had a stand-up comedian who tried to tell us the difference and the relationship between activities in the New Testament church that never got recorded in the book of Acts some way and our own activities today. It was not Grady Nutt, who was also in some of our classes. Rather, it was his colleague in comedy, Dick Hester. It was as funny as any comedy routine I've ever heard. Now, I won't bore you by massacring the lines I can still remember from that old sketch 30 years ago, but there is a connection with today. One thing that made it so funny was that Dick took ordinary events of our day and persons and events in the book of Acts and put them together in a new way. There was such an attention to detail and such insight into ourselves and the early church, but they were placed in juxtaposition in such a way as to be hilarious. As we've seen in his first two lectures, Professor Hester still has the attention to detail from which he derives insights to make us look at ordinary things in new ways. But he also has two other characteristics which I have watched grow and develop in the last few years and which contribute to his scholarship. In addition to seeking insight, he also seeks clarity. Many of us go through life in a muddle, never really sure who we are, where we're going, or how we will get there. Of course, as the old saying puts it, if you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. But Professor Hester presses for clarity. Many of us have felt his piercing, probing questions. What do you really think about that? What is your goal? What result do you want? How do you intend to achieve it? Tell me a little more about that. Will that method achieve the desired result? Clarity. He presses for it, and he's never satisfied until it's attained. Although Professor Hester genuinely seeks insight and clarity, he acts on the belief that they are enhanced by a third characteristic, collegiality. He has said repeatedly that the decisions and insights that come out of a good group process are stronger than those that come from any individual alone. And he acts on that basis. He recognizes his own fallibility. He listens. Many times I've seen him in a leadership role present a well-thought-out and creative proposal and then sit patiently and listen to others critique his ideas, often unmercifully. It is clear that what you and I say makes a difference to him. He then uses it effectively to strengthen his own insight and clarity. But if we will allow it to be, this collegiality can also be reciprocal. As we have experienced this week, what he says can strengthen our insight and clarity as well. Maybe that's one reason Professor Hester has become such a well-regarded authority on the family. He has welcomed many of us into his larger family, as fallible as we are, and has helped us function in some ways as family as we learn and grow together. And so I, along with you, await with anticipation the third lecture on the family by my colleague Dick Hester. And I can't wait to find out what happens to baby, cradle, and all in this final lecture entitled, When the Bough Breaks.
Thank you, Tom. Rock-a-bye baby in the treetop. When the wind blows, the cradle will rock. When the bough breaks, the cradle will fall. Down will come baby, cradle and all. In the midst of this well-known childhood lullaby, tragedy suddenly strikes as we hear the crack of the supporting bough. I'm indebted to my former grader, Dana Wallace Ryan, for this splendid title. The lecture could not possibly measure up to the title. What do we do when the bough breaks in our family, and how does God bring hope in the midst of our tragedy? In 1976, my parents came to visit us for Christmas. Soon after they arrived, I noticed that my father's speech was slurred, and neither of my parents was saying anything about it. Finally, I asked, "What is going on? What's wrong?" They said he had been to several doctors, none of whom could come up with a definitive diagnosis. I took him to a doctor who diagnosed his symptom to be the result of a stroke. Only several months later did a specialist accurately diagnose his disease as amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or Lou Gehrig's disease. My father was the emotional rock on which other family members had leaned: me, my mother, his sisters, his parents. Dependable and calm, always there when you needed him, able to fix things when they went wrong, able to make you feel better when they couldn't be fixed. Now he had a debilitating disease that rapidly would paralyze, and in little more than a year would kill him. I was shaken by his raw vulnerability. He got so desperate that he persuaded my mother to take him to a faith-healing evangelist. She told me the evangelist was a blatant huckster, a fact which my father, in his desperation, ignored. "I took him once," she said, "but never again." I couldn't believe my father, that rock, was so naive, so childish, so completely desperate. He was only 69 when he died 13 years ago, and I'm still trying to assimilate it. I was living out the pattern Ernest Becker describes, which we've discussed earlier, when he says we all unknowingly draw on hidden sources of emotional power, depending unconsciously on parents and other expressions of parental authority, whom we assume will protect us from suffering and failure, and most of all, from death. When our power source gets sick or goes crazy or turns on us or dies, the foundations are shaken. Then we face the end of a world sustained by the power we believe to be totally sufficient. In astonishing and even ridiculous ways, we will hold on to our power source long after it is evident to everybody else that the power is defunct, that the vow has broken. We don't want vulnerability in the gods who are our parents. It doesn't matter whether our experiences with parents were of a positive or a negative sort. We persist in giving them undue power nonetheless. If we don't want vulnerability in parental gods, neither do we want it in the unseen God, who is beyond all other gods. Jesus called God Abba, Daddy. And he told stories that cast God in the role of human parents. When he did, he set limits on God's power. As Jesus revealed in his relationship to his own family, the power of parenthood is limited power. We know that a crucial part of parenthood is that the parent recognize her limits or his. And we know that if she doesn't abide by these limits, if she tries to overstep them, effective parenting is undermined. If she attempts absolute control over the child, parent and child become trapped in a fused, symbiotic relationship that utterly distorts parenthood and childhood. Both parent and child in such a situation lose their emotional and spiritual bearings. If Jesus used the metaphor of parenthood for God, would he strip it of such an essential characteristic as the parent recognizing her limitations in relationship to the child? If we diminish or dismiss this characteristic of parenthood as it applies to God, then we eviscerate the metaphor of an essential part of its meaning. We shrink back from the notion God may be limited. It flies in the face of what emotionally we learn to believe in our earliest relationship with our parents, that parents are omniscient and omnipotent. That's the way it seems to the child. You stole your brother's Halloween candy out of the closet. You took it with you to Sally's house. You and Sally ate it. And that's why you are sick. The 5-year-old girl on the receiving end of this message looks amazed. "No, I didn't," she says. "Oh, yes, you did. I know." "How could you know?" she asks in astonishment. "Mothers have a way of knowing when children disobey. We always find out," says the parent, matter-of-factly. These are the words of an omnipotent being. No Wizard of Oz here who can be exposed as a fraud. This God knows everything. It's only a small step from this mysterious tremendum to the belief that the unseen God knows and controls everything. that happens. Jesus relativized the omniscient, omnipotent dimensions of parenthood that all of us acquire at an early age. And it was the actual finite parent, not the enlarged and fantastic one, that Jesus used as a metaphor to describe God's being. God is like the parent in the parable of the prodigal son. This God is no tyrant wielding absolute control. The creative power of the universe made known in Jesus is a cosmic parent who loves us and suffers with us in our finite existence. If we resist the notion that God is limited, we resist also the notion that God limited God's self in Jesus. We find it hard to accept a human Jesus, a Jesus who struggled as we do and who had difficulties with his family as we do with ours. In our view of Jesus, most of us feel pulled in a docetic direction. The earliest heresy in the history of the church was docetism, the belief that Jesus seemed to be human, but he really wasn't. A docetic view of Jesus keeps him in a realm separate from our existence, and it insulates God against any notions that God may, God's self, have limits. A docetic view of Jesus also separates him from his family. The church's 2,000-year history of docetism winning out over incarnation is fueled by natural human resistance to discovering and examining the painful actualities in our families. Docetism allows Jesus only to seem to be a member of a family without really belonging to that family. If we have difficulty accepting distressing realities in our own family of origin, it follows that we would have difficulty embracing such things in the family of the Messiah. Our anxiety over the ambiguity of good mixed with evil, of strength mixed with weakness, of success mixed with failure, attracts us toward idealization with regard to our family and toward docetism with regard to Jesus. I want to relate the two themes of idealization in the family and docetism in Christology by looking at docetism and how the fact of Jesus belonging to a family goes against the grain of a docetic view of him. In order to understand Jesus' humanity, it is necessary to appreciate how Jesus was a product of his environment, his heredity, and his family. Time will not permit us to look at the first two, environment and heredity, although those are challenging areas, but I want to focus on Jesus and his family as a territory in which to examine his full humanity. Contemporary family therapists and theorists tell us that the emotional system of the family determines a person's life more than environment or heredity, in that the family is the great mediator of meaning for the cultural environment and for one's biologically inherited characteristics. And here a brief detour into family systems theory, that developed by Murray Bowen and Michael Kerr. This theory assumes two fundamental forces in the family. It assumes an instinctually rooted life force, for differentiation that propels the developing child to grow up to become an emotionally separate and independent individual. It assumes another instinctually rooted life force for togetherness that propels the child and the family to remain emotionally connected and reacting to one another. The togetherness force pushes the child and family toward thinking and feeling and acting as one. The result of these counterbalancing life forces, the force for togetherness and the force for differentiation, says Kerr. The result of these counterbalancing life forces is that no one achieves complete emotional separation from his family. The early attachment is never fully resolved. According to this theory, emotional maturity is defined by the extent to which we are able to become differentiated from our families of origin and from other groups to which we belong. Well-differentiated persons are able to be individual selves and at the same time to stay in emotional contact with their family and other significant groups. A low level of differentiation expresses itself in emotional stuck-togetherness, in which family members encroach on each other's privacy and function at one another's expense. The path to emotional well-being involves the struggle to become a differentiated self. The effort to become a self separate from the pull of family togetherness inevitably creates conflict among family members. Efforts at autonomy provoke pressure from family members to stay in tune with the family's togetherness forces. Now, the gospel writers provide enough information about Jesus' relationships with his family for us to know that Jesus struggled to become self-differentiated. If Jesus had only seemed to belong to the family without being a part of the complex web of the family emotional process, as well as the product of the forces of environment and heredity, then he would not have contended with the members of his family to become self-differentiated. It would have been unnecessary, but he did contend with them. He went through the pain of getting differentiated from the compelling ties of kinship while he maintained a connection with his family. This struggle is preserved by Luke in the childhood paradigm narrative of Jesus disobeying his parents at age 12 and asking them, "Do you not know that I must be in my Father's house?" A childhood paradigm narrative expresses a central theme in the adult life of an historical figure in the form of a childhood story. The theme here involves the struggle for self-differentiation. Raymond Brown, the New Testament scholar, sees a possible second paradigm narrative in the Gospel of John. It's the familiar account of Jesus turning water into wine at the wedding feast of Cana at the request of his mother. It occurs in Jesus' early adulthood, and yet it takes place at a time when he was still living in the bosom of his family. Although Jesus does what his mother requests, turning water into wine in order to save a friend of the family from embarrassment, he rebukes her for not understanding his mission. "O woman, what have you to do with me?" he says, "My hour has not yet come." The synoptic gospels also make careful note of Jesus' public rebuke of his mother and brothers early in his ministry. The synoptic writers do it in a disconcerting redefinition of kinship. "My mother and my brothers are those who hear the word of God and do it." The evangelists don't conceal the conflict that Jesus provoked in his family by his acts of self-differentiation. In fact, they pick up the conflict as a basic issue. in his early ministry. These conflicts let us know Jesus was fully a member of a human family, just like us. The evangelists provide further evidence of Jesus' full membership in a human family in their accounts of the problems his belonging to a family created for his ministry. All four Gospels record that Jesus' family relationships were an offense to those who knew the family. Mark gives this striking account. He went away from there and came to his own country, and his disciples followed him. And on the Sabbath he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were astonished, saying, "Where did this man get all this? What is this wisdom given to him? What mighty works are wrought by his hands? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and the brother of James, and Joseph, and Judas, and Simon, and are not his sisters here with us?" And they took offense at him. And Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor, except in his own country, and among his own kin, and in his own house. And he could do no mighty work there, except that he laid hands upon a few sick people and healed them, and he marveled because of their unbelief." The hometown people were offended because Jesus was so obviously a member of an ordinary family. In this account, they joined the togetherness forces of Jesus' family, trying to set limits on what he said and what he did. Jesus' differentiation in his family and his differentiation from the people of his hometown are of one piece with his differentiation within first century Judaism. His getting differentiated from the forces in the family extended outward to him defining himself as a part of, but different from, the religious culture. At the center of this prophetic self-definition as Messiah was his work in his family. Evidence of his work of differentiation within his family provides striking confirmation of his humanity. He had to define himself within the same primal family forces that condition your development and mine. A docetic view of Jesus cuts him loose from his family and trivializes the gospel accounts that report his having conflict with them. We're attracted to such a docetic view of Jesus because we want to cut ourselves off from the painful family entanglements from which we suffer. Unresolved conflicts in family relationships get to the quick of the self, and our emotional defenses try to ward off this pain. We therefore tend to deny the impasse we feel with our mother or father or brother or sister or wife or children. An idealization of the family usually overlays this denial. We thus pretend that the family conflict isn't there. This kind of denial fits hand in glove with a docetic Christology. An idealized view of the family and an idealized view of Jesus, who wasn't really caught in the human entanglements of his own family, accompany and reinforce one another. The following is the case of a student who writes about growing up in a family that was trapped in denial and idealization. Within his narrative, the issue of docetism emerges. The student, whom I shall call Jeff, and with whom I have discussed this material, reports his earliest childhood memory. "In my first memory, I am almost five. My father interrupts my playing in my aunt's room to tell me my mother has died. He picks me up from the floor where I am playing with her paper dolls, and he sets me beside him on the bed. And he tells me plainly, she is dead. I don't remember his filling me in on the details or the like. I remember a focus on the future. We'll be all right, he said. I don't remember how or what I felt. I don't remember him crying. I have no recollection of my mother or of anything which occurred before that day. Within 2 years, Jeff's father was remarried. Jeff's father and stepmother, he says, tried to efface the memories of his mother. Whenever he disobeyed his stepmother, she told him he was defying her because she wasn't really his mother. About these episodes, he writes, my guilt-ridden response was repeated so often I came to believe it myself, but I do think of you as my mother. The effacement of his mother was so thorough, he says, that his father and stepmother permitted him and his brother to refer to her only by her first name and never as mother. Following an assignment that called for him to relate his early memory to a parable of Jesus, Jeff selected the parable of the wicked tenants, a difficult narrative that was reworked in various ways by the early church in order to resolve its unhappy ending. Drawing on the Gospel of Thomas, Jeff derived the following as the basic storyline of the parable. An absentee vineyard owner, a good man, sent a servant to the tenants to get the season's fruit. The tenants beat him nearly to death. He sent a second servant who got the same treatment. Finally, and inexplicably, he sent his son, and the tenants killed him, believing they could then seize the son's inheritance. End of story. Jeff worked hard with this perplexing text, trying to get past the church's allegorical interpretations. He followed an interpretation by John Crossan, who identifies the narrative as a parable of reversal, in which normal expectations are turned upside down. It is an account of a successful murder. The good guy gets killed, and the murderers get the victim's inheritance. Jeff concludes that the original parable ends with the murder and not with the owner's retribution against the tenants, as the synoptics report. He then says this, I think I see the parable addressing my myth at this point. My stepmother, with my dad's help, murdered my mother. They didn't push her off a cliff or poison her, but they did almost everything they could to keep her memory from living on in her children. All her personal possessions were given away. If it were not for her parents and her in-laws, my brother and I would not even have a photograph of our mother. And then he searches for any good news for him in the parable. And he says, this parable reverses the reversal under which I grew up. My mother, while certainly not perfect, was made out to be the villain. And my dad tried to get me to understand what a good mother my stepmother really was, despite whatever mean and nasty thing she had just done. And now this story of the vineyard shows the good aren't necessarily good, and the bad can go unpunished. The truth which this difficult parable evokes, he writes, is a liberating discovery. By refusing to participate in the deception about his family, he says, he can become free at last of its direct effects. For the first time, he began to see that he had for years taken part in a massive family deception. He and other family members had called normal a situation in which his stepmother suffered repeated depressions, often threatened suicide, and was beset by constant physical illness. They had called normal the denial of grief over the death of his mother, the effacement of her memory, and the idealization of his tormented stepmother. Jeff's father replaced his dead wife with a second wife, and the short-circuiting of his grief became apparent in the constant effort to blot out the son's memory of the first wife. Idealization is one result of such blocked grief. In many cases, the deceased person is idealized. In this case, the deceased became the object of unresolved hostility, and the wife who replaced her was idealized. Such idealization resembles docetism in Christology. In both cases, human actuality is denied, and an idealized person is created. The idealization leads us mistakenly to believe that we can escape the intractable problems of actual human existence. We pay a high price for this self-deception, however. This docetic way of thinking makes it impossible to believe that God works in and through actual human circumstances. God is viewed as one who acts outside of history and nature and not within them. In Jeff's family, the need to avoid pain leads the father to deny his massive loss. This cuts the family off from the healing offered by a God who suffers with them in their suffering, the God revealed in a fully human Jesus, who knows sorrow and grief. Although Jeff remembers nothing about his mother, he experienced her loss. For years, he and his family denied the loss. As he penetrated beneath the overlay of denial and idealization, for the first time, he began to face the truth of his predicament, and it helped him to take a different stance in the family. My stepmother may be unable to see things any other way, he says, but I am not obliged to change my language, my personality, my memories and values to humor her. Here he tells how he has lived out her expectations in his life, and he sees the destructive consequences of continuing to join in the family's denial of reality. Jeff selected a parable that appears at first to carry no hopeful word of God's action. Nonetheless, he felt hope in it by allowing it to shatter the unreal image of the family to which he had always subjected himself, an image that had kept him cut off from actuality. He came to understand that actuality is not an enemy, but a friend. Now, apart from Jeff's interpretation, I return to the parable as a narrative of incarnation. The following is the full text of the parable from the Gospel of Thomas. He said, a good man had a vineyard. He gave it to tenants so they would work it and that he would receive its fruit from them. He sent his servant so the tenants would give him the fruit of the vineyard. They seized his servant. They beat him. A little longer and they would have killed him. The servant came. He told it to his master. His master said, perhaps they didn't recognize him. He sent another servant. The tenants beat him as well. Then the owner sent his son. He said, "Perhaps they will respect my son." Since those tenants knew that he was the heir of the vineyard, they seized him. They killed him. Whoever has ears, let him hear. The story is not far-fetched. It reflects historical circumstances from the time of Jesus' ministry. The story is offensive because those described as good in the parable don't win out, and the murderers take what does not belong to them. Early Christians were so troubled by this parable that they rewrote it, making it into an allegory of Jesus' death and resurrection and the triumph of the Gentile church. This could not have been the point when Jesus himself told the story. His historical context prevents this construction. And Jesus wasn't trying to teach a moral lesson. None of his parables do that. Rather, his parables undermined prudential wisdom and heroic expectations. We don't want parables, Crossan reminds us. We want precepts, and we want programs. We want good precepts, and we want sensible programs. And we are frightened by the lonely silences within the parables. And this parable ends in a long, lonely silence. A parent appears in this parable as he does in the parable of the prodigal son. He is limited. Neither father has power over the fate of his son. Both fathers wait for news of the son. One gets a reunion, the other gets a death notice. Both parables describe the limits and vulnerability of parenthood, a parenthood that Jesus consistently used as a metaphor for God. Jeff chose to relate that tragic parable to his childhood memory of the death of his mother. Writing the paper disoriented, some months after he wrote it, he told me that this project had overturned his existing belief structure, a structure that had been built upon an idealized family image that blocked out the immense loss of his mother. For the first time in his work on this project, her loss hit him. I submit that the blow that struck him in his work with this parable is the leading edge of a gospel of incarnation. In order to hear the good news in this parable, though, he had to embrace its offensiveness. The parable offends because it describes the kingdom not as the scene of apocalyptic victory, but of tragedy. And that's what Jeff had been deprived of for some 20 years in his family, tragedy. The parable brought it home to him. The owner's son is murdered and the tenants take the inheritance. His mother was murdered and displaced by another woman. That's the enfleshed reality the family had ignored. The parable of the wicked tenants offends us because it reports the vulnerability of good, duly constituted authority. It offends us because righteous power doesn't crush evil persons. It offends us because it doesn't give us a cosmic general marching against evil power. It offends us because it leaves us with an unhappy ending reality, unidealized. It offends us because it is told by Jesus, who called God Abba, the cosmic parent to whom he cried from the cross, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" If there is a hopeful word in this awful parable, it comes in its tragedy and not in its victory. The parable is a paradigm of God's power, and it is the story of a foolish father. What kind of father would send servants on two separate missions, have them almost killed by his tenants, and then send his own son unprotected? By the standards of the world's wisdom, we would call that father a fool. Jesus tells about a naive, reckless father who exposes his son to forces so evil, the son is killed. That is, of course, the crucifixion story. The early church couldn't leave the story alone as a